A sociologist looks at human behavior in terms of the context of society. We are not entirely independent beings who make up our own lives as we go along. But we have been influenced in many ways and accept many of the values and ideas of our culture. In fact, we accept them to the point that often we do not realize how much we have been influenced by our culture, beginning with our family, in the educational process, and continuing throughout our lives. Roles and relationships are formed within the larger society. North America has undergone rapid change, so that right now there are a number of different patterns available for people present. This causes some confusion among us, as there is no longer a totally, quote, right, unquote, way of doing many things. At the same time, it means that since we need not all follow exactly the same pattern, people, both women and men, are more able today to act on the basis of their own individual abilities and interests than has been true at many times in the past and in many other cultures. However, we do know that males and females are still, to a large extent, raised somewhat differently. Not exactly the same things are expected of us as we mature in this country. Yet, it is my belief that some of these differing expectations are based on somewhat out-of-date ideas and assumptions about what is natural for males and females. So this afternoon, I want us to take a look at what are some of the real genetic differences between the sexes, and then at how those real variations might influence our possibilities. I think that we can discover, if we are not aware of it already, that some of the differences now prevalent between males and females in our culture are not biological at all, and do not have to determine our actions as much as has appeared to be the case previously. Obviously, in one short session, we are not going to cover everything or go into very much depth on anything. This is intended to be a thought starter more than anything else. And I also hope at the end of the session to have enough time left that anything else you might want to discuss about roles and relationships between the sexes, you can do. I have taught now sessions for 2 weeks, and I still have a lot of things I'd like to say. Can't do them all, but maybe we can touch on a few other things. Okay. The fundamental biological sex difference in humans is, of course, what?
Reproduction.
Right. Males do not, in fact, they cannot conceive and carry a child. That is a primary female role. Care for young children used to present a biological difference as well. How might that have been true?
When the mother is one child, dependent on another for nourishment.
Right. Most of recorded history, that was the case. It's really fairly recently that we have developed the technology that allows us to be able to nourish children apart from the mother. I myself nursed my three children for about 8 to 10 months each, and I found that to be an extremely satisfying experience. So I am in no way advocating the abolition of mother's role in caring for young children. That is not my intention at all. It is simply a fact, however, that if, for whatever reason, I had been unable to care for my own children in that way, or if I had died or something, they could still have lived. In the past, they would have had to have been cared for by another woman who could nurse them. So the biological differences between us don't stay the same from one era to another. Now, what differences do the reproductive differences impose upon us today? Last week in one session that I led, we discussed the fact that up until about the turn of the century, a woman's life expectancy was much shorter than it is today. Health care and improved nutrition means that most women today are able to look forward to having life go on into their 70s and perhaps 80s. At the turn of the century, life expectancy was generally thought to be about age 50 for women. And in time periods well before that, in some cultures it was 25 to 30. Okay. Now, of course, in any society there are some people who live a lot longer and some people who live shorter. These are average kinds of things. But it is just undeniable that in our culture today, women can look forward to a much longer life than was true previously. Now think about that a little bit. What would it have meant to have lived in a society where you couldn't really expect to live beyond 45, 50? What would the biological reproductive sex roles have meant for a woman's life?
Consuming most of it.
That's right. That was really all that was reasonably available to women. Especially coupled with the fact that it's fairly recently that we have any reliable forms of birth control. So that a woman either was pregnant, was taking care of children, or was potentially pregnant throughout most of her life, her adult life. Well, what does that mean then for people who live in that kind of circumstance?
Help them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they get the meaning out of life, too.
That's right.
And that's what life was.
Mm-hmm. Right. It meant, too, in many time periods and in many cultures, that a woman really needed special kind of protection and care because she was almost always caring for either her own body and preparing for a child or preparing for children.
Mm-hmm. I would guess also that as you measure the value of an individual, you measure the value of the individual in terms of what they contribute to society. And if in fact the only things available for you to contribute are to give birth to children and to care for them, therefore your highest value is in terms of your greatest ability to bear perhaps the most and raise the most children.
Mm-hmm.
If there are other things that you can do beyond that, of course, then you can mix the values or the value measures.
Mm-hmm. And that's especially true if the culture is such that families with a great many children if it was desirable for a family to have many children, such as in an agricultural society where more hands, could contribute to the...
And the other end of that spectrum would be unmarried woman wouldn't be as highly valued. Unless, of course, she could come and be a helpful nanny to the kids.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it is not surprising that in many cultures, in many parts of history, nobody could think beyond woman's role and her relationship with man outside of this context of reproduction. They didn't have the experience to have any other kind of insight about it. Okay. Now, our society, of course, is somewhat different. And yet, some of the ideas about what is natural for women still carry over. Now, I'm not trying in any way to denigrate motherhood or wifery or anything like that. I am merely trying to point out that it is no longer the case that all women need to follow the same sort of pattern. and the relationships then between men and women have the potential for many variations which were not even conceivable in past times. And I want to be sure to point out again, of course, that there have always been some variations in some societies. You know, not everybody followed exactly the same pattern, but the expectations were pretty generally true for most women. Okay, so those kinds of things just were a natural way of life. Well, what other kind of physical differences are there between males and females that you can think of?
Strength of muscle.
All right.
Size.
Okay.
Women don't have the privilege of going bald.
Not so frequently,
but. Or raising your beard.
There are
developmental
groups
who are going shirtless.
That's culture. Now, who said?
There are developmental differences, like such as boys. Little boys don't develop the ability to read because of the physiological maturing of the eye difference than little girls, or some other kinds of things like that that aren't quite so tied in with cultural.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Girls in our society mature more quickly, are able to develop some abilities more quickly than boys.
You said in our society, it's limited to our society.
Well, I am really trying to focus primarily on our society because that's what I know most about. And I do know of some cross-cultural studies which indicate that in some societies the developmental rates are different from what they are here. And since I don't know enough about that to make a comparison, I'm really trying to stick more to our culture. And in our culture, there isn't a whole lot of doubt about that most girls develop more quickly, mature more quickly than boys do.
Maybe I missed this, but when you say our culture, what are you? What culture?
North America.
North America?
Mm-hmm.
Western European too?
Well, that would be pretty much following the same pattern that we do, but not entirely, so on. I think it's safer if we really talk about ourselves. Well, let's see. There are a couple things to keep in mind here. When we look at any kind of variation among human beings, researchers develop what is called the bell-shaped curve. I don't want to spend too much time on stuff everybody knows, but let's be sure. That means that whatever we study, whatever characteristic or ability or whatever we study, there is the tendency to have a curve in which the majority will fit here and there will be some individuals at each end. Okay? In comparison between the sexes, on almost every kind of characteristic shows that they're supposed to look exactly the same, they don't. The curve for males, the curve for females is not on top of each other. You know, we don't have the same curve for males and females in a whole lot of characteristics. But the average, the mean of the curve for boys and the mean of the curve for girls, and what almost anything that you can think of to measure will be fairly close together. Closer together than the individuals within the curve for males or within the curve for females. So that means that if we want to look at height, how tall people are. Okay, the majority of males are going to turn out, here's the mean, the average. Males are going to turn out to be taller than girls. But there will be some boys who are shorter than some girls and vice versa. I'm not sure if I drew that exactly right, but does that make sense to you? Okay. So the variation within each sex is usually more extreme than the variation between the two sexes. And that's pretty important to keep in mind. The physical differences that we do know about are argued about by many of the researchers. And there are some political implications in talking about these differences too, and that's really why the arguments have developed. There have been studies during the last decade or so which talk about how hormones influence the brain in such a way that it's no wonder that boys do better in math and girls do better in reading. There are other people who say it's almost impossible to separate the social differences from the physical ones, and we don't know exactly where people fit on the scale and so on. So I really don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about that. But some of the kinds of differences that have been seen comparing boys and girls are that females generally have a greater verbal fluency earlier in life. They use language correctly more often. This is, again, the average person. They're better at spelling. They're better at manual dexterity, better at clerical skills, better at rote memory. Boys tend to be better at verbal comprehension and reasoning, mathematical reasoning, spatial perception, the speed and accuracy of their reactions to various stimuli, their mechanical aptitude, and problem-solving ability. There are some researchers, some psychologists, who say what we ought to do is determine exactly what the differences are between boys and girls and then train them to follow the pathway that would make the best use of their abilities. And the problem that develops out of that, of course, is that then we start thinking that everybody ought to fit into the same mold. All the girls ought to be given a certain kind of education because girls typically develop in one way or another. Boys should be given a different kind of education. And the ones who don't fit then are in trouble because they're being squeezed into a different kind of mold from what their real true abilities are. Dr. June Reinisch, who is the director of the Kinsey Institute now, which is now a much different kind of research institute than it was once upon a time, came to my campus last year and gave a talk about the biological differences between males and females. And I remember one of the comments that she made, if we did train males and females to do what they're best at, we would come out with some very different categories than what we have right now. She said, for example, the best astronauts probably would be females because their bodies tend to be smaller, so they would fit into the space capsule better. Their manual dexterity happens to be better in general. And the way the body mass reacts to weightlessness is more satisfactory for females than for males. They don't suffer some of the same illnesses that have been associated with space travel and so on. She said, we don't do that. You know, obviously, we aren't in the practice right now of trying to fit the natural abilities to a specific kind of operations. Okay, now, even though we do have some very visible differences between the sexes, the size and the strength, for example. You know, there's no doubt about that. That kind of difference in the past was very important in the sort of use of abilities that people made. When the trees had to be felled and the ground tilled and water hauled and all of those things that were very much dependent on size and strength, then it made sense to separate males from females because males could perform some of those kinds of actions so much better than females could. Well, in our society today, how many of our occupations are based primarily on size and strength? There are some, but not nearly the proportion that there were in the past, because our society is based more on the manipulation of ideas and information rather than things. So this is another way in which we need to rethink what the natural tendencies of people are. Okay, anybody have any comments to make about any of this?
Well, in regard to astronauts, just one comment. There's a lot of other things that astronauts expect to do, which involve rational, logical thinking, mm-hmm. as well as physical reactions. And so therefore, there perhaps are other factors to consider when selecting astronauts.
Yeah, well, Dr. Reinisch said you can find the females that can do those things too, and then choose between them. That was the point she was trying to make. Well, okay, now, how about differences in mental capacities? There's a whole lot of experimentation being done on this topic today, and there are some theories that say the hormones acting upon the brain tend to be very different for males than females, that testosterone and other androgens tend to help males develop the left side of the brain, which is the analytic, conceptual, sequential kind of thinking. And estrogens and progesterone. Okay, thank you. In females, tends to develop the artistic, emotional, non-analytic parts of the brain. And there's still a lot of study that has to be done about all that, the proportions of it, and so on. What has been true in the past has been not so much a look at what kind of mental cognitive abilities lead to what kind of production, what kind of results. We're beginning to look at those sorts of things today. But formerly, people just looked at the fact that women were not writing great symphonies and great plays and achieving the heights in many kinds of occupations, and assuming from that this must mean that women did not have the abilities to do those sorts of things. Now I'd like to read you a little excerpt from a book by Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf was an author who, I think she died in the 40s, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you. Sometime back, I was in a play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Some of you may have seen that play or the movie. I did not have Elizabeth Taylor's part. I was the dumb blonde. At that point in my life, I had no idea who Virginia Woolf was and why this play was named for her. Since then, I have discovered something about her, and I used this book, A Room of One's Own, in courses that I teach now. It's a series of lectures that she gave back in the 30s. And much of it is still very useful today. She talks about this fact that women have not shown up in the lists of people doing great things in the world. And she imagines what it would have been like if Shakespeare had had a sister, if the sister would have been able to achieve the same sorts of things that Shakespeare did. Let me imagine, since facts are hard to come by, what would have happened had Shakespeare had a wonderfully gifted sister called, let us say, Judith. Shakespeare himself very probably went to the grammar school because his mother was an heiress, where he may have learned Latin and the elements of grammar and logic. He was, it was well known, a wild boy who poached rabbits, perhaps shot a deer, and had, rather sooner than he should have done, to marry a woman in the neighborhood, who bore him a child rather quicker than was right. That escapade sent him to seek his fortune in London. He had, it seemed, a taste for the theater. He began by holding horses at the stage door. Very soon he got work in the theater, became a successful actor, and lived at the hub of the universe, meeting everybody, knowing everybody, practicing his art on the boards, exercising his wits in the streets, and even getting access to the palace of the queen. Meanwhile, his extraordinarily gifted sister, let us suppose, remained at home. She was just as adventurous, as imaginative, as agog to see the world as he was. But she was not sent to school. She had no chance of learning grammar and logic, let alone of reading Horace and Virgil. She picked up a book now and then, perhaps, one of her brothers, and read a few pages. But then her parents came in and told her to mend the stockings or mind the stew and not moon about with books and papers. They would have spoken sharply but kindly, for they were substantial people who knew the conditions of life for a woman and loved her, their daughter. Indeed, more likely than not, she was the apple of her father's eye. Perhaps she scribbled some pages up in an apple loft on the sly, but was careful to hide them or set fire to them. Soon, however, before she was out of her teens, she was to be betrothed to the son of a neighboring wool stapler. She cried out that marriage was hateful to her, and for that she was severely beaten by her father. Then he ceased to scold her. He begged her instead not to hurt him, not to shame him in this matter of her marriage. He would give her a chain of beads or a fine petticoat, he said. And there were tears in his eyes. How could she disobey him? How could she break his heart? The force of her own gift alone drove her to it. She made up a small parcel of her belongings, let herself down by a rope one summer's night, and took the road to London. She was not yet 17. The birds that sang in the hedge were not more musical than she was. She had the quickest fancy, a gift like her brother's, for the tune of words. Like him, she had a taste for the theater. She stood at the stage door. She wanted to act, she said. Men laughed in her face. The manager, a fat, loose-lipped man, guffawed. He bellowed something about poodles dancing and women acting. No woman, he said, could possibly be an actress. He hinted, now you can imagine what. She could get no training in her craft. Could she even seek her dinner in a tavern or roam the streets at midnight? Yet her genius was for fiction and lusted to feed abundantly upon the lives of men and women and the study of their ways. At last, for she was very young, oddly like Shakespeare the poet in her face, with the same gray eyes and rounded brows, at last Nick Green, the actor manager, took pity on her. She found herself with child by that gentleman, and so, who shall measure the heat and violence of the poet's heart when caught entangled in a woman's body? And so she killed herself one winter's night, and lies buried at some crossroads where the omnibus is now stopped outside the Elephant and Castle Tavern. That more or less is how the story would run, I think, if a woman in Shakespeare's day had had Shakespeare's genius. It was unthinkable that any woman in Shakespeare's day should have been able to achieve what Shakespeare did. And then she goes on to talk about the fact that Anonymous was often a woman. And many of the women who did decide to write in those earlier periods used men's names to sign their works. Otherwise, there was not a chance that their thoughts would have been shared among anyone else. And she talks about the fact that that idea of suicide for a very gifted person was probably quite real. And in fact, Virginia Woolf herself committed suicide at a later point. Well, where should we go in this discussion?
Are all of the differences between men and women to be restricted to the field of biology?
No. The point that I would like us to think about is the fact that in the past, and to some extent in the present, biological differences have led us to think that there are natural ways in which males and females act. And this has defined what our roles and relationships could be.